I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is my evening with Joan Didion. She is reading from Blue Nights, her second smashing meditation on death. And I'm her interlocutor and foil, again, on stage in Cambridge, with the woman of the considered written word, not the spontaneous spoken word. This is a tricky job, and it didn't solve for me the puzzle of Didion's power. But how could I not share it? Or you not respond? This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Joan Didion is a writer's writer, gone suddenly in her 70s, rock star and phenomenon, meeting a hungry market for introspections on death, both sudden, as in the case of her husband, John Gregory Dunn, and Didion's 2005 bestseller, The Year of Magical Thinking, or slow and almost unfathomable death, which came to Didion's adopted daughter, Quintana, at 39, and provoked Blue Nights. 600 readers bought books and tickets to hear Didion and pack the first church in Harvard Square last night. It's a great privilege for me to be continuing a conversation with Joan Didion. It began 5 years ago around the Year of Magical Thinking, and it resumes on around this remarkable book and remarkably written from the first word to the last. Joan Didion, would you just begin maybe by reading this opening page and a half on what you mean by Blue Nights?
Yes. In certain latitudes, there comes a span of time approaching and following the summer solstice, some weeks in all, when the twilights turn long and blue. This period of the blue nights does not occur in subtropical California, where I live for much of the time I will be talking about here, and where the end of daylight is fast and lost in the blaze of the dropping sun. But it does occur in New York, where I now live. You notice it first as April ends and May begins. A change in the season, not a warming, not at all a warming. Yet suddenly summer seems near, a possibility, even a promise. You pass a window, you walk in Central Park. You find yourself swimming in the color blue. The actual light is blue. And over the course of an hour or so, this blue deepens, becomes more intense, even as it darkens and fades, approximates finally the blue of the glass on a clear day at Chartres, or that of the Cherenkov radiation thrown off by the fuel rods in the pools of nuclear reactors. The French called this time of day l'heure bleue. To the English, it was the gloaming. The very word gloaming reverberates, echoes, the gloaming, the glimmer, the glitter, the glisten, the glamour, carrying in its consonants the images of houses shuttering, gardens darkening, grass-lined rivers slipping through the shadows. During the blue nights, you think the end of day will never come. As the blue nights draw to a close, and they will, and they do, you experience an actual chill, an apprehension of illness at the moment you first notice. The blue light is going, the days are already shorter, the summer is gone. This book is called Blue Nights because at the time I began it, I found my mind turning increasingly to illness, to the end of promise, to the dwindling of the days, to the inevitability of the fading, the dying of the brightness. Blue nights are the opposite of the dying of the brightness, but they are also its warning.
One of the astonishments of this book, as I'm sure a lot of you have discovered, is that it reaches an incredible power talking about frailty and examining frailty very individually and very, I don't want to say mercilessly, but carefully and honestly and bravely. I'd love you to read, Joan Didion, the passage that begins on page 109 and involves a chair in a rehearsal room.
All right. I finally found it. Weeks pass, then months. I go to a rehearsal room on West 42nd Street to watch a run-through of a play, a new production of a Broadway musical for which two close friends wrote the lyrics in the 70s. I sit in a folding metal chair. Behind me, I hear voices I recognize. The two close friends and their collaborator who wrote the book. But I feel too uncertain to even turn around. The songs, some familiar and some new, continue. The reprises roll around. As I sit on the folding metal chair, I begin to fear getting up. As the finale approaches, I experience outright panic. What if my feet no longer move? What if my muscles lock? What if this neuritis or neuropathy or neurological inflammation has evolved into a condition more malign? I once in my late 20s had an exclusionary diagnosis of multiple sclerosis, believed later by the neurologist who made the diagnosis to be in remission. But what if it is no longer in remission? What if it never was? What if it is returned? What if I stand up from this folding chair in this rehearsal room on West 42nd Street and collapse, fall to the floor, the folding metal chair collapsing with me? Or what if another series of dire possibilities occurs to me, this series even more alarming than the last? What if the damage extends beyond the physical? What if the problem is now cognitive? What if the absence of style that I welcomed at one point, the directness that I encouraged, even cultivated, what if this absence of style has now taken on a pernicious life of its own? What if my new inability to summon the right word, the apt thought, the connection that enables the words to make sense, the rhythm, the music itself, what if this new inability is systemic? What if I can never again locate the words that work?
Do we get it? I mean, she's telling us about this style, which she's been honing for 40 years, and in the fear of losing it, she's showing us how she does it. And in worrying about his absence, she's dazzling us again with it. I mean, it seems to me this is the wonderful paradox and power of this book, if I may say.
Well, thank you.
The frailty theme goes on. There's another. I'd like to read just one little moment of relief from it, if I may. I think I like this even better than you do. But there's a moment when Joan Didion has been ill, and as she writes, somewhat to her surprise, she finds that she actively likes physical therapy. She writes, "I keep regular appointments at a Columbia Presbyterian sports medicine facility at 60th and Madison. I'm impressed by the strength and general tone of the other patients who turn up during the same hour. I study their balance, their proficiency with the various devices recommended by the therapist. The more I watch, the more encouraged I am. This stuff really works, I tell myself. The thought makes me cheerful, optimistic. I wonder how many appointments it will take to reach the apparently effortless control already achieved by my fellow patients. Only during my third week of physical therapy do I learn that these particular fellow patients are in fact the New York Yankees loosening up between games." I told you they'd like that.
I know. That's why I'm smiling.
Would you read sort of back to fragility on page 137?
A doctor to whom I occasionally talk suggests that I have made an inadequate adjustment to aging. Wrong, I want to say. In fact, I have made no adjustment whatsoever to age. In fact, I have lived my entire life to date without seriously believing that I would age. I had no doubt that I would continue to wear the red suede sandals with 4-inch heels that I had always preferred. I had no doubt that I would continue to wear the gold hoop earrings on which I had always relied, the black cashmere leggings, the enameled beads. My skin would develop flaws, fine lines, even brown spots. This at 75 was what passed for a realistic cosmetic assessment. But it would continue to look as it had always looked, basically healthy. My hair would lose its original color, but color could continue to be replaced by leaving the gray around the face and twice a year letting Joanna at Bumble and Bumble highlight the rest. I would recognize that the models I encountered on these semi-annual visits to the color room at Bumble and Bumble were significantly younger than I was. But since those models I encountered on my semi-annual visits to the color room at Bumble and Bumble were at most 16, 17, there could be no reason to interpret the difference as a personal failure. My memory would slip, but whose memory does not slip? My eyesight would be more problematic than it might have been before I began seeing the world through sudden clouds of what looked like black lace and was actually blood, the residue of a series of retinal tears and detachments. But there would still be no question that I could read, write, navigate intersections without fear, no question that it could not be fixed, whatever it was. I believed absolutely in my own power to surmount the situation, whatever the situation was. When my grandmother was 75, she experienced a cerebral hemorrhage, fell unconscious to the sidewalk not far from her house, was taken to the hospital and died there that night. This was the situation for my grandmother. When my mother was 75, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, did two cycles of chemo, could not tolerate the third or fourth, nonetheless lived until she was 2 weeks short of her 91st birthday. When she did die, it was of congestive heart failure, not cancer. But was never again exactly as she had been. Things went wrong. She lost confidence. She became apprehensive in crowds. She was no longer entirely comfortable at the weddings of her grandchildren or even, in truth, at family dinners. She made mystifying, even hostile judgments. When she came to see me in New York, for example, she pronounced St. James Episcopal Church, the steeple and slate roof of which constitute the entire view from my living room windows, quote, "the single ugliest church I have ever seen." When, on her own coast and at her own suggestion, I took her to see the jellyfish at Monterey Bay Aquarium, she fled to the car, pleading vertigo from the movement of the water. I recognize now that she was feeling frail.
There's a passage that I love that would give, that does give any parent sort of chills. You're looking at photographs from Malibu, including pictures of a wash line, and you know, I wrote two books watching her clothes blow on those lines. This is Quintana's clothes, of course. And you quote her list of mommy's sayings, or mom's sayings, including this one, "Brush your teeth, brush your hair, shush, I'm working." But you're looking at the photographs anew, and you write, "What remained until now unfamiliar, what I recognize in the photographs but failed to see at the time they were taken, are the startling depths and shallows of her expressions, the quicksilver changes of mood. How could I have missed what was so clearly there to be seen?" I mean, We've all been there. We're all still there in a certain way. I wonder, Joan, do you think of doing things differently?
You always think of doing things. I mean, as a parent, I think you always think of doing things differently, and you think of doing them not in some definite. There's no definite way to do them differently. You simply you think of doing them differently just for the sake of doing them differently. It's a kind of no-win proposal.
But don't we all think of our children at 2 or 3 or 5 or 7 or 9 and wonder and long for another look?
Mm-hmm. Another chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lovely passage I'd love you to read in which Sophia Loren has a supporting role.
Definitely supporting.
Maybe her only supporting role. Yeah.
I find myself studying in a copy of the New York Review of Books a magnum photograph of Sophia Loren, taken during a Christian Dior fashion show in Paris in 1968. In this photograph, Sophia Loren is sitting on a gilt chair, wearing a silk turban and smoking a cigarette, achingly polished, forever soigné as she watches the bride, the traditional end of the show. It occurs to me that this magnum photograph would have been taken not long after Sophia Loren herself had been the bride. In fact, twice the bride, married in France to Carlo Ponti for the second time after the annulment of their original Mexican marriage, the marriage for which he had been charged with bigamy and threatened with excommunication, a scandal at the time. It has become hard to remember how reliably scandal once came our way. Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, a scandal. Ingrid Bergman and Roberto Rossellini, a scandal. Sophia Loren and Carlo Ponti, a scandal. I continue studying the photograph. I imagine the object of this particular scandal leaving Dior and going to lunch in the courtyard of the Plaza Athénée. I imagine her sitting with Carlo Ponti in the courtyard eating an éclair with a fork. The vines that line the courtyard blowing slightly. Sunlight glowing pink through the red canvas canopies over the windows. I imagine the sound of the little birds that flock in the ivy, a twittering, a constant presence, and an occasional swelling of birdsong. I imagine her leaving the Plaza Athénée, photographers flashing around her as she slides into a waiting car on the Avenue Montaigne. The cigarette, the silk turban. It strikes me that she looks in this photograph not unlike the women in the photograph Nick took at Quintana's christening. Nick was my brother-in-law. Quintana's christening was in 1966. This Christian Dior show was 2 years later, 68. 66 and 68 were a world removed from each other in the political and cultural life of the United States. But they were for women who presented themselves a certain way, the same time. It was a way of looking. It was a way of being. It was a period. What became of that way of looking, that way of being, that time, that period? What became of the women smoking cigarettes and their Chanel suits and their David Webb bracelets? What became of Diana Hall holding the champagne flute and one of Sarah Mankiewicz's mitten plates? What became of Sarah Mankiewicz's mitten plates? What became of the clay tennis court at the house on Franklin Avenue in Hollywood? The court I watched Quintana weed on her fat baby knees. What gave Quintana the idea that weeding a tennis court on which no one ever played was a necessary task, her assignment, her duty? Was weeding the unused tennis court at the house on Franklin Avenue something like equipping the projection room at her doll's house in Malibu? Was weeding the unused tennis court something like writing a novel? Was it one more way of assuming an adult role? Why did she need to assume an adult role? Whatever became of those fat baby knees? What became of Bunny Rabbit? As it happens, I know what became of Bunny Rabbit. She left Bunny Rabbit in a suite at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel in Honolulu. I learned this halfway across the Pacific when she was sitting next to me in the darkened upstairs cabin on the evening Pan Am back to Los Angeles. There was still a Pan Am then, there was still a TWA then. There was still a Pan Am and there was still a TWA, and Bendel's was still on West 57th Street. And it still had Holly's harp chiffons and lettuce edges and sizes 0 and 2. Sitting next to me on the evening, on that evening flight back to Los Angeles, my child mourned Bunny Rabbit's cruel fate. Bunny Rabbit was lost. Bunny Rabbit was left behind. Bunny Rabbit had been abandoned. Yet by the time we taxied into the gate at LAX, she had successfully translated Bunny Rabbit's cruel fate into Bunny Rabbit's cruel fate into Bunny Rabbit's good luck. The Royal Hawaiian, the suite, the room service breakfast, the white sand, the swimming pool, walking to the reef, swimming off the raft. Bunny Rabbit was even now, we could be certain, swimming off the raft. Swim off the raft, walk to the reef. Imagine a 5-year-old walking to the reef. Like when someone dies, she used to say, don't dwell on it. How could I not still need that child with me?
The little sequel there about Sophia Loren is Joan's discovery that Sophia Loren was born in the same year she was. And she writes, this entirely meaningless discovery floods me with restored hope, a revived sense of the possible.
And it's like doing physical therapy with the Yankees.
Could I presume to ask you a slightly different question? But I was just thinking, you write that your husband, John Gregory Dunn, had scheduled a baptism. He was a Catholic. You'd scheduled a baptism, but he took it upon himself to baptize Quintana himself.
In the sink. Not in my presence.
Exactly.
He didn't keep it a secret afterwards. He told me he had done this, but it was definitely done not in my presence.
Well, this was a good Catholic instinct from West Hartford, Connecticut, and I can identify with that. But I'm also just wondering, if I can ask, there is something very, very bleak about this book and about your staring down death. As John Benville writes, there is no escape, there is no refuge, even in art. But I just wonder what Quintana's father would say, even to you today, expressing his own view of another way of looking at it, a Christian hope or bomb.
I don't think he was not into Christian hope. He didn't. No, I mean he definitely baptized Quintana, but it wasn't as in the spirit of hope. It was in the spirit of fear. I mean, this was real West Hartford.
Do you want to unfold West Hartford a little bit?
No.
Probably not that different from a lot of Boston.
No. Actually, West Hartford wasn't too different from Sacramento either. That was one of the reasons John and I got along so well, is we were both from the same... We were from totally different places. In fact, his family didn't even come to my wedding because I was not a Catholic, even though I was married in a Catholic church. But we were exactly the same. We thought what we used to call it in code was Hartford, Sacramento.
Code four,
we're the same.
Just sort of summing up, I'm just struck that you write so well and so hard and so carefully and so precisely about frailty. How do you account for your power? And I mean that very, very seriously. You're at the peak of your writing career, it seems to me, and you've moved everybody, every reviewer, and everybody in this church.
Well, thank you. But I mean, I don't actually feel that way, you know.
Well, but I mean it seriously in the sense that I think you're showing us an example of industry and production and seriousness and inquiry and openness and curiosity and meticulous observation, sort of whether you feel up to it or not. And I think it's a
really lovely thing to say. Thank you.
Well, no, I mean it. I think we all feel, you know, let's go out and hit it out of the park the way Joan Didion does.
Well, not every time.
I'm sure the Yankees were watching you very carefully. Thank you.
One beauty of Blue Nights, I was trying to say, is that when Joan Didion writes frail about herself, what we remember is the opposite, indomitable. But I've got to get down the odd gaps in this book. They're disquieting and then illuminating. This is her Quintana book for the daughter who died, but there are just traces of Quintana in it. The mother and writer has preempted all the suffering and mourning in this sad story. Quintana's wedding day is central, but the man Quintana married is just barely named. About Quintana, we learn that she had abandonment issues as an adopted only child under the roof of two driven writers, that she graduated from Barnard, became a photo editor at Elle magazine, that she drank too much and got desperately sick twice in her 30s and died. But we do not meet Quintana past her teens. We learn, as Didion writes, that Quintana is one of the areas about which I have difficulty being direct. Blue Nights is Joan alone, Joan's loss, Joan's frailty, Joan's distracted mothering. What the book is really tracing may be the arc of Joan's writing career more than Quintana's life, as Nathan Heller writes in the New York Times. So the book about Quintana is really about Joan, and for me, the evening with Joan is really about the audience, including me. Were we there as inadequate parents, as mortals in fear of death, or maybe as a Didion support group who came to feed more than be fed, or, not so happily, were we there as groupies around a brand, famous as Didion is for dropping the brand names of cake makers and grand hotels? Would we have been there last night? Would I have posted these words if her name were not Joan Didion? Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation with our associate producer, Henry Peck. Listeners, please read Blue Nights and help me out with a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being a necessary part of this Blue Nights conversation.